From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This Friday, the 113th Congress adjourns for August, 5 weeks off. Without a very unlikely tsunami of last-minute productivity, they will have enacted fewer laws by this point in the session than any Congress since record-keeping began in 1973. They may yet get a VA deal pushed through, but big picture, it's being called, especially by Democrats, a do-nothing Congress. But the world doesn't stop. This hour On Point, the cry of a do-nothing Congress. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's it mean for the U.S. Congress to stall out? Are you glad to have it sitting on its hands or worried? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The record is standing right there. Lots of complaints about it as the five-week August recess comes up. Here's Democratic Rep. Dan Kildee of Michigan talking on Thursday, last Thursday on the House floor.
We are about to embark on a one-month legislative recess as the House Republican leadership continues to block action on legislation to create jobs and to grow the middle class.
Do they deserve that time off? No, said the Democratic representative.
Instead of taking those up, we're about to leave town for a month of undeserved time off.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz sees it altogether differently. Not a Republican problem, not the Republicans' fault. It's Harry Reid's fault. Here he is talking with NBC's Kelly O'Donnell.
I can't control the agenda on the Senate floor. The reason we have no votes on tax reform is because Harry Reid won't allow any votes on tax reform. The reason we have no votes on regulatory reform is because Harry Reid won't allow any votes on regulatory reform. The reason we don't even spend a minute talking about substantive issues to generate economic growth and jobs is because Harry Reid won't allow the votes. At the end of the day, the Senate used to be called the world's most deliberative body. We don't debate anything nowadays.
And then there are those who don't want Congress to debate and do. We'll hear from them in this hour as well, the Tea Party view here. Joining me first from Washington is Thomas Mann, longtime Congress watcher, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Norm Ornstein of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track, and it's even worse than it looks, how the American constitutional system collided with the new politics of extremism. Thomas Mann, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be with you again.
Is it fair to call this a do-nothing Congress?
Oh, I think it is. Historically speaking, it's been as unproductive, whether measured simply by numbers of measures passed or, more importantly, by its failure to address the bread-and-butter issues that normally functioning Congresses do on a regular basis. It's not a pretty picture, Tom.
I'm looking here at a graph that goes way back in time at the number of bills enacted during each Congress. This is to the first 544 days of this Congress, and it has got the smallest number that I can see anywhere on this chart. I mean, it does ebb and flow. There are Congresses that are more productive than others. There are Congresses that are less. What is pushing this one down to the extreme low output position, Tom?
Well, you can't blame it on individual members of Congress. You can't say there's something that is peculiar to this Congress itself. What's going on here, Tom, is a very simple reality. We live in an era of intensely polarized and competitive political parties. They're distant from one another ideologically, and they are competitive enough for control of the majority in the House and the Senate, as well as the White House, that the legislative process turns into an extension of the campaign itself. You add to that the fact that the party in opposition to the White House, the Republicans, have control of the House, and they're determined that there be no record of accomplishment for their enemy, the president. So you've got a vehement opposition party in a separation of power systems where negotiations and compromise across party lines and across institutions and along Pennsylvania Avenue is essential to getting anything done, and one political party is determined that nothing shall get done.
Trying to understand this, Tanya is listening to NPR News this morning. It comes to us on Facebook quoting a senator there saying the doctor could tell them they have a kidney stone and they would refuse to pass it. Okay. listen, it's polarization. We get that, and that's been there for a while now. But even when you get down, you talk about individual congresspeople. I mean, here's a report. This was from Derek Willis in the New York Times a month or so ago, a couple months ago, saying that the number of lawmakers who have even introduced at least a couple dozen proposals in this Congress has fallen by two-thirds, that the number of congressmen and women who have produced five or fewer pieces of legislation has jumped 81%. So even when you get down to the granular level of individual representatives and senators, there's less being proposed, Tom.
But that's, you know, that's realistic because they could introduce 100 times that number of bills and it would have zero impact on what Congress does. That's not how legislation emerges. Serious legislation comes from the administration. It emerges from the standing committees. It's picking up on real problems that arise and confront the Congress. Most individual bill introduction is for political show back home, not for doing the legislative work of Congress. Again, this is not a shortcoming of individual members not doing certain things. This is the fact that – and the public hasn't faced up to this yet – that when they in their voting patterns produce divided party government, that is one party controlling the White House and the other party controlling one or both houses of Congress, they have provided a formula for inaction, for gridlock, for partisan war, and not for lawmaking. It just doesn't work in these times with these polarized political parties, with this level of competition between the parties for control.
You're saying you get what you vote for in a sense there. Of course, that could change as soon as the midterms this fall. We'll look at that. We could have an all-Republican Congress, Capitol Hill, come November.
But Tom, that you think there's any chance of that making things better? All that means is that we'll get the same gridlock on all the important legislative matters because there's a Democrat in the White House and the president has a veto power.
Oh, boy, do nothing again. Great.
Override.
Change the complexion and it's still do nothing. Tom Mann, stand by. We'll hear from the Tea Party perspective in this hour. We're going to look at what it costs, all this. We'll look at that midterm and what's likely to happen there. Let's hear from our listeners. Keith in Austin, Texas. Keith, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, my point was that the system's actually working the way it's supposed to. Our founders put together the separation of powers and the bicameral legislature to slow things down when there was this kind of deep division. You know, when we have this much extreme thought going on both ends of the spectrum, it's important to make sure that neither party can do anything rash simply by getting a simple majority.
But how does that work out, Keith? Let's say that we're headed toward a cliff and we refuse to turn right or left. Do we just drive straight off the cliff, Thelma and Louise style?
Well, the question is, are we sure that there's not a cliff to the left or the right?
Yeah, yes, fair.
You know, I mean, that's the problem. And what this system is supposed to do is force us to take a step back and go, where did we go wrong? Why are we on a road that ends in a cliff anyway?
Keith, stand by. Tom Mann, how about it? This is the way it's supposed to work.
No, I don't think so. It's true the framers were concerned about unwise temporary majorities. They were afraid of the accumulation of power by a particular interest, and so they set up a system that really required negotiation and compromise across divisions and across institutions. But mind you, they didn't want an ineffectual government. One of the things they were reacting to was the inaction under the Articles of Confederation. They wanted the capacity to govern, a positive government, to deal with problems that confront us. But it did require – and by the way, the founders never mentioned the word political party. Those arose mm-hmm. after the beginning of our republic. But they certainly expected in the end that that we would be able to have compromise. Unfortunately, now we've got a set of political parties that are parliamentary-like, and there is no negotiating across party bounds because there's a political incentive to make the guy in the White House look bad by not letting anything happen, and that might improve prospects for the opposition party in the midterm elections.
Hey, Tom, 10 seconds before the break, do we have the luxury of just waiting out this gridlock, this polarization, doing nothing?
On certain things, the answer is no. The infrastructure transportation bill has to be renewed or we're going to fall back into a recession.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with just days to go before its big August recess about our do-nothing Congress, why it's doing next to nothing, the cost of doing nothing, and for some, the advantages of doing nothing, maybe the necessity as we battle out political differences here. Thomas Mann is with us, co-author of The Broken Branch, and It's Even Worse Than It Looks, joins us from Washington and the Brookings Institution. President talking about this, saying he's ready to do things. Here he was in Austin, Texas, earlier this month, joking about being tired, he said, of doing all the work in Washington by himself.
If you're mad at me for helping people on my own, let's team up. Let's pass some bills. Let's help America together. It is lonely, me just doing stuff. I'd love if the Republicans did stuff too.
John Boehner, having none of that all the way last July, here he was on CBS's Face the Nation, saying, look, there's a reason for all this. We're fighting for what we believe in.
We should not be judged on how many new laws we create. We ought to be judged on how many laws that we repeal. We've got more laws than the administration could ever enforce. And so we don't do commemorative bills on the floor. We don't do all that nonsense. We deal with what the American people want us to deal with. Unpopular, yes. Why? We're in a divided government. We're fighting for what we believe in.
We've got more laws than we can even enforce, than we even need. Emma in Nashville, Tennessee. Emma, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. My comment was just that I am really disappointed with our Do Nothing Congress. The American system was created so that two sides, or as many sides as there are, can disagree, but ultimately come to a consensus, come to a decision that will represent the wishes of the American people and their majority. This Do Nothing Congress really... it's really disappointing because these are some of the most well-educated, well-paid individuals in the United States. We elect them. We choose them because we believe that they can do what we need them to do, which is pass bills.
And if they don't, Emma, what are you worried about?
I'm worried that we are going to end up in another, congressional shutdown like we did last year, that people are going to lose the things that they need, the public services that they need, because adults are bickering like children.
Emma, I've got a note here on my screen that says you're 15 years old. What are you thinking about the U.S. Congress and the way it's working or not working?
I am thinking that it's a lot like my kindergarten class was. I'm thinking that it's kids who don't know how to share, who are taking their toys and not letting other people play with them and saying, if I can't have it, no one can. And it's really disappointing.
Of course, people have strong beliefs. As we heard John Boehner say there, they're fighting for what they believe in. There's Emma, 15 years old in Nashville, looking out on her future and wondering where it heads. Emma, I appreciate your call. Tom Mann, please stand by. Harry Holzer joins us right now from Washington, professor of public policy at Georgetown University, former chief economist for the U.S. Labor Department under President Bill Clinton. Harry Holzer, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
What does it – I mean, people have serious political positions that they're defending and they're attacking on here. What about the costs to us of the paralysis that so far is so often resulting? How do you tote them up, Harry?
There's a huge cost. You know, I'm an economist, so I look at what are the economic costs of doing nothing right now, and I think those costs are huge. First of all, we still have an economy with a lot of weakness, a labor market with a lot of weakness. A functioning Congress could have done more to help stimulate the economy and create more jobs.
Does that mean you're buying President Obama's view of the economy, that what we need is stimulus?
You can call it stimulus, or if not, you can have well-targeted efforts to create more jobs, like repairing the infrastructure. You know, there's broad consensus that the infrastructure is crumbling. There's millions of unemployed workers. Interest rates are close to zero. It will never be as sensible a time to invest in infrastructure as it is right now, but Congress blocks action on that. Tax reform, there's broad consensus that the corporate tax needs fixing, and there's ideas about how to fix that. That costs our economy. Immigration, the broken immigration system creates a lot of drag on the economy. The Senate actually passed a very good bipartisan bill with strong support on both sides. And none of these things get done because they go to the House of Representatives, and the House GOP makes sure those things die. So the costs of not doing all those things that otherwise would have fairly wide support, I think, for the American economy is very high.
But we heard Senator Ted Cruz of Texas at the top of this hour on tape saying, look, give us the wheel here, and we would act on tax reform, on regulatory reform, on the economy.
No, there's no acting on it, given the fact that the gaps between the two parties are unbridgeable, at least between the Senate and the House. Now, there's other gaps between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. Getting 60 votes is hard. It's not impossible, as the immigration bill showed us. No, but Senator Cruz blaming this on Harry Reid's intransigence, I think, misses the point.
And I mean, here we are. Look around. The world is really changing. There's a lot going on. The president says, you know, he'll use the telephone and a pen to do a lot, to do what he can. Is it enough for a country of the United States' size and significance? Do we need more active governance out of Washington? Or maybe the Tea Party's got it right. We'll ask in a moment. But, you know, that we've had too much, the dead hand of government, so a little paralysis may not be the worst thing.
No, I don't think that's true. The president, the things he can do through executive orders are really very, very limited. We have big problems that can only be solved legislatively. I mean, take the issue of the fiscal crisis. You know, not right now, but 10, 20
Soon
years
enough.
Down the road, we're facing huge, huge crisis in our fiscal situation. It requires a grand bargain between the two sides, where you have reforms in retirement programs, but also higher tax revenue. We need to do that. And the only way to do that is legislatively. The same thing for tax reform, corporate tax reform, the same thing for immigration, even things in terms of education and healthcare. The only way to do that is legislatively, and it's impossible to do that given the current climate.
Tom Mann, but that is the climate. We do have the polarization. You tie it right back to voters and who they're putting in Congress. I mean, if that's a reality, we've got polarization. We've got people looking different ways for solutions here. Do we have the option? I guess we're in the midst of it, of sort of waiting out the standoff?
No, I think that's why the president is doing what presidents under these circumstances always have done, which is to try to take steps, even though, as Harry said, the opportunities are limited, to use presidential power, administrative authority, to move some issues ahead. A primary example is climate change. We can't afford to wait forever. And the president actually has been able to do quite a bit with fuel economy standards originally, and now dealing with coal-powered electricity plants. I mean, there are steps that can be taken in the face of this this intransigent opposition, but they're few and far between. Listen, it's true. A generation ago, when the parties had sort of less ideological zeal, a little more overlap, it was possible to legislate during times of divided party government. But that is over with. And if the public wants action out of their Congress and their government, they're going to have to entrust power to one of the political parties at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue and give them the opportunity to put a program in place and then stick around long enough to keep the other party from trying to undermine its implementation.
One of the two parties, you say, of course, has become even a little more complicated than that within the GOP, where Tea Party's been a very big voice, not always fully lined up with mainstream Republicans, and in the eyes of many, important in sort of putting the brakes on action here, and sometimes proudly so. Tom Mann, Harry Holzer, stand by. With us right now from Dallas, Texas, is Katrina Pearson. She's a Tea Party activist, spokesperson for the Tea Party Leadership Fund. Katrina Pearson challenged Republican Congressman Pete Sessions in the primary for Texas' 32nd Congressional District, was defeated in March, but she's still out there beating the drum. Katrina Pearson, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Are you worried about the lack of action in Congress, about a do-nothing Congress? To you, as a Tea Party person, is that a problem, Katrina?
Not at all, Tom. You know, the experience with this administration alone that Americans have experienced is that we are actually better off with a do-nothing Congress than a do-something incompetent Congress. We can't really continue this narrative, this novelty narrative of it's Republicans' fault, it's Republicans' fault. We have to remind people that this administration had all three branches of government at one point, and fiscal year 2009, spending was almost increased at $203 billion, and as a percentage of the economic production was the highest level since World War II, and has only declined slightly since. But here's the thing. We are not a democracy. And your other two guests are talking about this issue as if we are a democracy.
What do you mean we're not a democracy? Isn't that what we are first and foremost?
Absolutely not. We are a republic.
Well,
we are
a Republican democracy, but okay.
Vote,
yeah.
Which means the people vote to who they want to represent. And after the wonderful Obamacare bill that was passed, when Obama had to do something, Congress, people vehemently opposed to this because it's not what the people wanted. This Congress should be acting to the will of the people, not to the will of their parties and what they want to see happen.
But let me ask you something, Katrina. So here we are. I take your point, and you clearly have people who share this perspective, and no small number of them in Congress. But in a world where there's so many changes underway, so many challenges, can we just put a rock on the accelerator, you know, and tie the steering wheel in a fixed position and let it go where it goes? I mean, don't we need to be responding to the world?
Well, absolutely not, because we're not responding to the world. We're responding to the will of certain individuals who have money to make. I mean, for example, let's use climate change. We have a president who is in scandal after scandal after scandal, from Benghazi to IRS to the border, Fast and Furious, DOJ, NSA spying, targeting American citizens. And we're talking about climate change? I mean, what direction do you want this country to go is the question. And here's the number one fundamental thing that people are not discussing. And that is, the federal government has a purpose, which was in its source documents, to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote general welfare, and to secure the liberty of ourselves and our prosperity. Nowhere in there does that say to your 15-year-old caller that it's the federal government's responsibility to provide necessities to people.
How do you think the general welfare is going to be doing if we don't deal with climate change? That could be a little problematic. And talk about moneyed interests. We've got, you know, we've got fossil fuel interests who are all over that issue. It's not as though that's just on one side. But I just come back to this. You think the federal government, the Congress, should just kind of get out of there, do nothing, and everything will work out fine, Katrina?
Well, they're actually not doing, quote-unquote, nothing. I mean, Obama is still using his pen and his phone, which he criticized George Bush for, and you don't hear any outrage on the Democrat side of things. But the question is, what does he want to do? The things that he wants to do, the American public doesn't agree with. Look at this.
Well, I mean, they elected him to office, but you clearly represent some, and some right there in Congress. Mary in Buffalo, New York. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. Hello.
Hi.
My comment is basically on the inaction of Congress. The reality is that from day one of the Democratic administration, the Republican Party has not wanted to cooperate or at least meet Democrats halfway. As long as the Congress is in control of the Republicans and the Democrat is in the White House, nothing's going to get done. With a Democrat in the White House, Congress would be a majority of Democrats, then legislation will get passed. There's no way anymore for both sides to meet because there's complete extreme ideology on the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side, they don't want to give up their, they don't want to compromise on what is their basic ideology.
Yeah, you paint it very plainly, and there we stand. Thomas Mann, you hear Katrina Pearson's view. You know, we're better off with a do-nothing Congress than doing what this president wants, in her view. So bring on the paralysis.
I think Emma wins the contest with Katrina. I think Katrina reflects a sort of a populist, radical view of American government. It's not one that has basically dominated our history.
Does that make you an Obama partisan to see it that way, Tom?
I don't think so. I've spent my 45 years managing to be a student of the process and not a partisan. Sometimes it's led me to criticize Democrats, but right now, and there have been populist left-wing movements that have done some harm and demanded their way, or the highway. It's the spirit of Emma that's so important here. We can't stay by our own certainties. We can't demonize our political opponents. The magic of our system is the acceptance of diverse views, the legitimacy of the political opposition, and the willingness to engage in evidence-based, fact-based negotiation and compromise. And that's not on the plate of the Tea Party today, and they've proven to be very influential within the Republican Party.
Let me ask Katrina. I've just got you for another minute, Katrina. You, in the end, I mean, we admire you for being part of the Democratic process, for running in the Republican primary. In the end, you didn't beat Pete Sessions. Does that mean that your hardbar view on this, your view of what's going on in Washington is ebbing, that it's losing ground, Katrina?
Well, not at all, considering I only ran a campaign for 4 to 5 months and still ended up with 42% of the vote on election day. So that right there speaks volumes. But we do use facts. We do see the failures in government, the failures in government programs, and the scandals in government. But let's just take the partisanship away from it since, you know, we're labeling the Tea Party as extreme. Let's talk about billionaire investor Sandy Druckenmiller, who made headlines when he said default might be worth the pain because it would force the government to tackle its debt problems, which, by the way, economist James Ramsey of New York University said there's some things to that argument. So it's not just Tea Party people. There are actual professionals who are part of the process for a very long time who agree with that side of the argument.
Katrina, we've got it. Still plumping, maybe even for default there. Katrina Pearson with the Tea Party Leadership Fund in Dallas. I appreciate your being with us today. And Harry Holzer at Georgetown University. Harry, thank you very much for being here. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking just days before a 5-week August recess about what's being called a do-nothing Congress. Why that's happening, the cost of that situation in Washington, who welcomes it, who opposes it, and what it means for this country going forward. Thomas Mann is with us, co-author of The Broken Branch and It's Even Worse Than It Looks, joins us from the Brookings Institution in Washington. Tom Mann, stand by. Nancy Cordes joins us right now from Washington, congressional correspondent for CBS News. We love hearing from Nancy. Nancy, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's so great to be back with you.
Great to have you. Harry Holzer was just with us from Georgetown. We appreciate that. And Katrina Pearson with the Tea Party Leadership Fund down in Dallas. You're there covering Congress. You've done that for a while. Do you feel the stillness in the air? Does do-nothing sound fair to you, Nancy, even as we talk about a Veterans Administration deal maybe in the works this week?
Right. I think for that reason, you're going to have to change the name just this week from a do-nothing Congress to does a little bit Congress, because they did strike a deal to give the VA some significant help in trying to reduce this backlog of treatment for veterans. It didn't look like that was going to happen. Last week, it looked like that whole deal was falling apart, but they did agree on some pretty significant reforms that comes with a hefty price tag, and it's likely that the House and Senate will pass that by the end of the week. It also looked like Congress was not going to be able to prevent the Highway Trust Fund from running out of money. It looks like that's going to get taken care of today as well. And we might even, by the end of the week, see some action on dealing with this immigration crisis at the border. It's not going to be anywhere near what the White House wanted. The president had asked for almost $4 billion. And if something does happen, it's going to be much smaller. It's going to be about $600-700 million, but it would get you through September, and Congress could come back and work out something more long-term. So look, this is not anything that Congress should be patting itself on the back for. Congress said that these things were crises, so they should deal with them. There's still a lot that's being left undone, but at least they were able to figure out a few things before they left for this long August break.
Tom Mann, look at the big agenda. Look at those points of potential action this week on the VA, on stopgap funding in the Highway Trust Fund, on maybe a little for the crisis at the border. Look at those. Is it time to throw away the do-nothing Congress sign, Tom?
I don't think so. I think we're defining deviancy down. listen, you always get stopgap measures at before recess when doing nothing would prove politically damaging to both sides. That's what's happened here. You can't desert the veterans seeking health, so you got to do something. Immigration is radioactive, and taking no action is vulnerable. But you look at all these pieces, and it like the infrastructure, which the patch is, it's so embarrassing to do this with the transportation bill. It's,
what do you mean by that? What's embarrassing here, Tom?
Embarrassing is to have a couple of month extension of the bill that's been up for renewal forever. This is a perfect time with interest rates so low to set aside the funds for a decade-long focus on improving our infrastructure. It would be good for economic growth and opportunity, but we can't do it. I mean, it's the steps being taken are the most that they can do, but they are truly patrolling it at the margins. It saddens me to see that what we've often called the greatest legislative body in the democratic world is now really become a joke. And sadly, it's one you don't smile or laugh about. You mainly cry about.
I mean, you look around the world and our infrastructure's relative ranking among developed nations is sinking and sinking. Nancy Cordes, there was a time that this was the country which people looked to be figuring out the future. I mean, in Congress itself, do people there buy the notion that they're now sort of behind a paralysis nation?
Absolutely. You have important members of Congress, folks like Senator Bernie Sanders, who was able to work out that VA deal, saying, look, this is big because Congress, as we all know, is dysfunctional. Many members will tell you point blank, we are a dysfunctional body. You know, we're not ailing, we're not limping along. We are simply not performing the basic roles that we should be performing. And what's really sad is that often, even when you do see legislators come to agreements, they will say, look, point blank, we don't think that this is very good policy. We just think it's the best we could do because doing this or doing that was politically unpalatable. We couldn't get it past this base or that base. And so they pass legislation when they do, knowing full well that it's really not going to get the job done, that as Tom Mann pointed out, that it's just going to mean more expense in the long run. But nobody here seems to be able to think about the long run. That's just not popular. They need to prove, conservatives in particular, need to prove that they're not spending any money. Democrats need to do things that their base likes as well. And so you have major things going undone. It's very frustrating to watch at close range.
I mean, we should point out, of course, it was Republican Jeff Miller of Florida, along with Bernie Sanders, who put this VA deal together. So it's not as if it never happens. What about that portion of Congress? We had on a Tea Party activist, Katrina Pearson. She didn't make it through the Republican primary, but she got a decent chunk of the vote in Texas. And there are many others who share her view. She was saying just a few minutes ago, Nancy, you know, we're better off with a do-nothing Congress.
Right.
Is that a live wire still in Congress? Is that an influential view? Is it receding? Is it growing? Is it just standing fast?
Well, it's a very influential view, and I think, you know, you've got a core of about 30 or 40 House Republicans who feel that way, who came to Congress because they felt that Congress needed to do less, not necessarily that Congress needed to make policy that was less expensive, but that Congress should be meddling less in general. And so when you've got House Republican leadership, for example, trying to put together a bill to deal with the crisis at the border, you know, when they try to come up with policies, those policies cost money, and they're running into a problem where if you've got 40 members of your party who are saying, if it's cost money, we're not going to vote for it, then your only other option is to try to craft policy that will appeal to Democrats. And if you do that, then some of your other Republicans are going to jump ship.
You're saying because those 40 can block passage, or because their opposition makes everybody else shy about jumping on board?
No, it is that, you know, once they say we're not going to vote for this if it costs any money, then that means Republicans can't pass it on their own, and
yeah,
they need to pick up some
yeah
Democratic votes. But there may be things, you know, Democrats, for example, don't like the Republican approach to dealing with the border crisis, and they say, well, if you want our votes, you're going to need to drop X and Y.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are a lot of Republicans, just mainstream Republicans, say, well, you know, I'm fine spending the money, but only if you do X and Y. And so that's where.
So there we are. Joe in Worcester, Ohio. Joe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm well. What do you see, Joe?
You know, I just want to start off by saying, first off, I'm former U.S. military, okay?
Okay.
And I was, when I was in the military, and it wasn't that long ago,
mm-hmm,
I heard about a study, and you have to forgive me because the name of the university that did the study escapes me, but there was a study done on a group of high school students, who were asked to come up with their solution to a lot of the problems that the government is facing. I mean, everything from immigration to the debt to any of the major problems that the government is really facing is really divided on.
Yeah, high school kids
right
tasked
now
to do it, and did how'd they do, Joe?
Actually, they did really well. The university looked at their results and looked at their answers, and they said, these are things that might actually work. So what is it that our Congress and senators can't figure out that have college degrees and a college education that these high school students are able to outsmart you?
Wow.
How is it that high school students are beating you at your own game here?
Joe, I appreciate your call. It's a good question. Nancy Cordes, is it fair? Do we have insoluble problems and so we're not solving them? Or Joe says, look, a bunch of teenagers in a room could do it.
The leaders on many of these issues, they know what the solutions are. From the right and the left, they will tell you point blank, look, here's what we basically need to do on Medicare. Everybody knows it. Or here's what we basically need to do on immigration. Everybody knows it. So it's not a question of what the right policy is often. It's a question of the political will. And the other problem is that it's a lot easier to make policy that costs money when your government is running a big surplus, because then people sure. don't freak out as much if you mm-hmm. say this is going to cost an extra $10 billion or mm-hmm. an extra $5 billion. But when you've had lean times like we have for the past 5 or 6 years, when the government has been running a deficit because, you know, partly because the economy just hasn't been that strong, you're not bringing in as much tax revenue, then any policy measure becomes a fight. Are you going to pay for it or not? How are you going to pay for it? There's not a lot of excess money in the system, so, you know, then people end up fighting over where that money's going to come from, and deals fall apart. So, you know, partly what you're seeing is the challenge of legislating in a rather weak economy where you don't have as much money to work with.
Let's get another call here. Jed in Nashville. Jed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually have 2 points. The first one is, and this is in response to Katrina's remark that we are not a democracy, and yet she quoted, you know, the preamble to the Constitution of the United States was automatically, we the people infers democracy. I'd really like to just clear that up.
Thank you.
And second point is that if a contractor is set to do a job and he has a contract to do a job and he's agreed to do a job and he doesn't do that job, the contractor loses the contract and is no longer paid. Now, we did elect the officials in the Congress, these representatives, to do a job. And if they're not going to do their job, then either they need to surrender the jobs to someone who will do it or quit taking the money for it.
Jed, we've got it, though I think the way that works in our system, as you suggest, is you vote them in or you vote them out. But I appreciate your call and the little constitutional we the people reminder. Troy in Garner, Iowa. Troy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think divided government works the best, but there's only one problem with that is if you don't have a strong leader. You look at Obama's leadership dealing with John Boehner versus a Reagan dealing with a Tip O'Neill or a Clinton dealing with a Newt Gingrich, and there's a distinct difference. Divided government is the way to go, but without a strong leader, it is not a good way to go.
Troy, I appreciate your call. Tom Mann, how much of this can we put back on the White House?
Almost none.
Well,
I really
Troy would beg to differ.
I really must beg to differ. We tend to glamorize all the great successes. Bill Clinton had a brief moment after humbling Newt Gingrich when the Republicans shut the government down to get a couple of bills passed, but it lasted a very brief time, and then there was automatic Republican opposition to everything else he proposed, and then they impeached him.
Ouch.
Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan managed to work together on some brief matters, partly because, first of all, the Republicans had control of the Senate, and there were 40 or 50 conservative Democrats in the House. So there was the ingredients to govern under these circumstances. Today's circumstances are dramatically different. If Obama's for it, Republicans are against it, even if they were for it a year or two ago. The Affordable Care Act is a case in point, a Republican plan for the most part that has now been demonized so much that it's taken on a symbolic meaning. And yet in the meantime, millions and millions of Americans are signing up. And in spite of the public opinion data, it turns out that was quite a success.
Nancy, if voting is the way to fix or change things, what appears likely at this point from the midterm elections? They're coming up pretty soon now. In the House, in the Senate, what are the polls suggesting we're likely to see happen?
I don't think you'll see much change. I think that as it stands right now, Republicans stand to pick up a few seats, most likely, in the House. They stand to pick up a few seats in the Senate as well. If they took over control of the Senate, which is very possible, that would be a dramatic change for the president's relationships with Congress, for the president's ability to get things done. Republicans will argue that if they take control of the Senate, that actually that's the best chance for change, because then the president has no choice but to work with Republicans. And if he wants to have a legacy, then those last 2 years that the two sides would work on something that they truly agreed on.
Tom Mann says no way. If you get a Republican Senate majority, you'll just get gridlocked down Pennsylvania Avenue. Mm-hmm. What about that view, Nancy?
I think that that's also very possible, but I think the one caveat to that is that if Republicans want to take the White House in 2016, they need to prove that they are a governing party. So they'd need to have something to show for those 2 years of controlling the House and the Senate. So as much as the president would need to work with them, they would need to work with him as well. But judging by how difficult it's been for the two parties to work together the past 6 years, you're right. We don't have much hope that they're all that good at working together. It's just that there would be a lot of political pressure on them to do so.
Nancy, for Americans worried about do nothing capital, what's your suggestion?
Watch a sitcom. go watch House of Cards. I don't think it's changing anytime soon. So if you don't like the news, maybe divert yourself elsewhere. But it's important, and if you really care about it, make your feelings known in the voting booth. Get out there and write letters to your members of Congress. Those do make an impact. Members do read those and do understand what their constituents are saying. So I think that's really the best hope.
Nancy Cordes with CBS News, thanks as always for being with us. And Thomas Mann of Brookings, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.